76, 78, 80. Where the hell is this place, anyway? Clea Mars stopped on the sidewalk and put her hands on her hips, looking down at the doors she'd just passed. She'd been to some tiny dives in her time, that was true, but she'd never had so much trouble actually finding a place before. Sighing, she retraced her steps. She was beginning to regret suggesting this article to her editor, as fascinating as the subject matter promised to be. Rumors about the Theater of the Observer, after all, had been circulating for months. Everybody was talking about it, but nobody seemed to know anyone who had actually attended a performance. Probably because no one can find it, Clea thought with a bitter smile. She dug a scrap of paper out of her pocket and studied it. The sun had just sunk behind the skyscrapers, but there was still enough light to read her hastily penciled chicken scratch, 78 and a half Leonard Street. Clea looked up at the numbers over the doors again. There was 78, and there was 80 right next to it. So where? Startled, Clea realized that there was something between the two doors, something she hadn't noticed on her previous two passes. She stepped closer and squinted into the deepening gloom. It was a narrow fissure, like an alley, but only wide enough for a cat to squeeze through, it looked like. She frowned. Surely a theater, even a small one, couldn't fit in there. Clea glanced up and down the street. It was deserted and getting darker. The streetlights hadn't even flickered to life yet. And apart from the rush of faraway traffic, the immediate area was eerily quiet. Cursing herself for opening her big mouth about this assignment, she crept toward the alley, every now and then glancing up toward the lighted windows of the surrounding apartment buildings, just to reassure herself that there were other humans nearby. As she approached the gap between the houses, she spotted a low iron stair railing that had been virtually invisible from the street. Half a dozen steps descended onto a damp cobblestone path, which led up to a flat black door embedded in a wall. She could just make out the number 78 and a half, scrawled on the door in what appeared to be silver spray paint. Clea considered her options. Technically, she didn't have to write this piece. There was certainly no shortage of weird theater troupes doing their avant-garde thing in the city, and she could just as easily write about another one of those. Her editor wouldn't care. Most people who read their paper weren't trolling for cutting-edge performance art to check out anyway. They just wanted to know what hipster bands were playing and where the cheapest drink specials were. Still, though, this Theater of the Observer thing had been nagging at her, she had to admit it. She had first heard about it a little over a month ago from another writer at the paper, who'd heard about it from the usual friend of a friend. In the void of real information about the place, all kinds of bizarre stories had sprung up about it. The most widely told of these was that some people who attended the performances were apparently never seen again. Silly rumors didn't really faze Clea. She figured it was all some sort of viral marketing hype. But she was intrigued nonetheless, and wanted to see firsthand what all the mystery was about. Or maybe, she thought to herself, I'm so jaded that I can't wait to see something really new and different. Chuckling a little, she hitched up her shoulder bag and began making her way down the steps. She had to walk sideways until she reached the bottom, but then the narrow alley widened enough to allow her room to move normally. The stones felt almost squishy beneath her feet, and she wrinkled her nose at the thick smell of mold and urine that assaulted her senses. She would have to take a nice hot shower when she got home from this little adventure. The doorknob felt slick under her hand, and she nearly retched as she turned it. Jesus, she knew these troops were hurting for money, but it didn't cost anything to be clean, did it? Her fingers slipped off the metal and she wiped them on her jacket. The door was locked. So what now? She noticed a peephole in the door and wondered if someone was watching her through it. The thought made her arms prickle with goose flesh, and then she chided herself. This was a public theater, right? So what was she getting all freaked out about? But that thought led to another. If this was indeed a public theater, where was everybody? Maybe they were all already inside, she told herself. Maybe she was late, or maybe she was too early. The anonymous source on the phone had told her to go to the theater at 6, but maybe he'd been mistaken. In fact, now that she considered it, maybe she wasn't even in the right place. Maybe the theater itself was nothing but one of those urban legends, and someone was playing a joke on her. She stood in the alley, trying to breathe through her mouth, the stinking miasma seeming to thicken around her. What if all this was a prank? She turned and looked behind her. It was too dark to see very well, although she thought the streetlights had finally come on. She didn't see anyone walking by, but this was mostly a residential neighborhood, and it was a weeknight, so that wasn't terribly unusual. Still, it would have made her feel a lot better to see an old man amble by walking his dog, but there was no one. Clea turned back to the door. Was there a flicker of movement or light behind the peephole? She couldn't be sure. Her heartbeat suddenly seemed very loud in her ears. For Christ's sake, she thought, don't just stand here like an idiot all night. Either knock on the door and see what's what, or head back to the subway station. She nodded in agreement with her inner voice. She was being stupid, just hanging around. She raised her fist and rapped on the door. For a second, nothing happened, but then the knob clicked, and the door swung inward. Clea couldn't see anyone inside. It was like a black hole. There was no sound in there at all, no music, no crowd noises. She stood on the threshold for almost a full minute, staring into the darkness. This isn't the right place, her inner voice informed her. Better turn right around and get the hell out of here. It was certainly sound advice, and Clea had every intention of following it. She turned to leave, but then another voice, a real one, stopped her in her tracks. Are you here for the show? It asked. Clea laughed to herself, a little relieved. Yes, she answered. Sorry, I didn't know anyone was here. She turned back and looked into the blackness. She still couldn't see anyone. Where are you? It's so dark. Come farther inside, the voice said. Clea couldn't tell if it was a man's voice or a woman's. There'll be a light in just a moment. Leaving the door open behind her in case she had to make a fast getaway, she edged forward into the building. Her fingers searched and found walls on either side of her, forming a hallway only barely wider than the alley had been. The floor beneath her felt hard and cold through her shoes. The mold smell was weaker here, but still present, and mixed with the unpleasant aromas of old sweat, stale perfume, and rancid meat. She walked carefully, feeling her way, hoping her hands didn't meet anything unexpected. "Geez, you guys not pay your electric bill or something?" she said, trying to sound nonchalant. The voice didn't answer. At last, Clea could see a light, and she quickened her pace to go toward it. The depth of her relief startled her. Perhaps she'd been more uneasy than she'd realized. She turned a corner and entered another long hallway. The light was coming from an open door at the end of it. "Almost there," she called in her forced, jolly way. There was still no response from the voice. Her mouth twisting, she pushed ahead, already thinking of the first sentence of the article she was going to write about this place. It appears that the Theater of the Observer is erroneously named as one must navigate seemingly miles of pitch-black hallways like a blind person before one even arrives at anything resembling a theater. It needed work, she knew, but it was a decent start. She was also being presumptuous. She had yet to encounter anything that looked like a standard theater, after all. As she moved along the hall toward the light, she became aware of a series of what looked like badly rendered paintings along the walls. They were all done in luminescent paint on black velvet, and Clea thought wryly of those cheap bullfighter paintings she'd seen for sale at the flea market. But her smirk died away when she actually looked at the artwork. They were all of eyes. Big eyes, small eyes, some wide and frightened, some narrow and conniving. All were painted in bright primary hues that seemed to vibrate against their black settings. All seemed to glare at her with livid intensity, as though they expected her to do something, like it roasted on a spit, perhaps. Clea suppressed a shudder, then chastised herself again. How could a bunch of ineptly done paintings upset her so much? They looked as though a bright but disturbed 6-year-old had done them. Did the geniuses behind the theater really think they would scare people so easily? She tried to laugh dismissively, but no sound came out. She couldn't help glancing sidelong at some of the paintings as she passed. They were really creepy. She shook herself and fixed her gaze straight ahead. The light that glowed from behind the door had a bluish tinge, and for a moment she thought she could see shadows moving, large and ponderous. She considered calling out again to whoever had spoken to her, but she thought better of it. Maybe all this was part of the immersion experience of the show, part of its manufactured mystique. This thought made her feel a little better, although a vague tension remained. Finally, Clea passed through the door, the blue light nearly blinding now, like the glow from an alien spacecraft. Just ahead, she could make out the silhouette of a balustrade, and beyond that, the suggestion of a high ceiling with a dangling chandelier, whose crystals winked lazily, sending beams of refracted sapphire light in all directions. Clea glanced around, looking for a ticket booth or a refreshment stand, but the balcony was apparently empty. Puzzled, she walked to the edge and placed her hands on the railing. It was fairly dim, but she could see rows of theater seats spread out far below her, and before these a stage with a heavy blue curtain, which was closed. As she squinted down into the darkness, she thought she could see people in some of the seats, no more than a few dozen. At least she wasn't alone here. The silence and emptiness was beginning to get to her. She turned around. How had those people gotten down there? And then she spotted it, a small sign pointing downward on the top of a staircase. She headed toward it, thinking the ticket sales were probably handled downstairs. Maybe she'd even come in the wrong entrance. Yes, she thought, that had to be it. That would explain why there was no one around, why she'd ended up on the balcony. Her step was lighter as she made her way down the stairs. At the bottom, there was a sharp left turn. The blue light bathed everything, giving the scene a surreal aspect. Another turn and she was confronted with row upon row of theater seats, every chair upholstered in what appeared to be the same blue fabric as the curtains. The seats were a little shabby, but not as worn as she would have expected, given the exterior of the place and the neighborhood where it was located. She could see the other patrons a bit better now, although none of them turned to look at her. The nearest person was a thin, bearded man, sitting very straight, two or three rows behind. Clea didn't much like the idea of sitting near the middle of the theater, but she didn't really want to sit right on the end either. She compromised and chose a seat two seats over from the aisle, trying to be as quiet as possible, then settled in and pulled her notebook and pen from her shoulder bag. After about 15 minutes had passed, during which she'd made a few general notes about the theater for her article, she began to get restless. She looked around the room surreptitiously, thinking she was doing something wrong for some reason. No one else seemed to have moved, and no one looked bored or impatient. Everyone just sat still and stared at the curtain as though they had all the time in the world. And who knew, thought Clea, perhaps they did. 10 more minutes passed. Clea had begun to doodle a series of sinister-looking eyes in her notebook next to her scribblings. They seemed to be looking disapprovingly at her, so she scratched them out, the sound of her pen tip very loud in the silent theater. Finally, the curtains twitched, and the lights got slightly brighter, though no less blue. There was a strange sound, like a collective breath being released. Clea leaned forward, suddenly attentive, her pen poised between her fingers. The curtains slid open with a whisper. There were no lights shining on the stage itself, but by the glow of the house lights, Clea could see several glints, as of metal or glass. As she watched, bluish lights began to flicker on over the stage. At first, she wasn't exactly sure what she was looking at. From her vantage point, the glints resolved themselves into a row of large glass jars, of the type medical specimens were usually kept in. Clea immediately flashed back to her high school biology class, to the shelves full of similar jars containing pig fetuses, diseased human lungs, and any number of revolting things. She wondered if this was going to be some kind of freak show deal, with two-headed snakes or kittens with no eyes. If so, she wasn't impressed. More lights flickered on. Now she could see that the jars contained what looked like very realistic human heads, floating in a syrupy solution. She made a note of this in her book. How very Grand Guignol, she added in the margin. She stifled a yawn, then focused her attention on the stage again. The stage was now lit up like the Vegas Strip. The jars, Clea noticed, were sitting on a long, uncovered table, about 3 feet off the floor. Dangling from the bottom of each jar was a thick electrical cord. These cords snaked back into the darkness behind the stage and disappeared. The smell of formaldehyde and rotted food began to reach her nostrils. She glanced around, but no one else seemed bothered by the smell. It wasn't bad yet, but if it got worse, she might have to go outside and be sick. If she could even make it outside. There was another long silence as everyone sat there and stared at the heads. Clea shifted in her seat, wincing when it squeaked. No one appeared to have heard. Then, in unison, the eyes of all the heads opened. Some of the people in the audience did move then, straining forward a little, their expressions anxious. Clea had to admit the effect of the eye-opening had surprised her, but now she was interested in how the trick had been achieved. The cords must work the eyes on the fake heads, she figured, then decided that the whole thing would have looked a lot cooler if the troupe had managed to hide the cords a little better. She made a note of this, then glanced back up. The heads stared into the crowd. Clea could see them all perfectly well now, a row of expertly severed heads, realistic down to the drifting arteries emerging from the necks. Some of the heads were male, some were female. Most were young, but a few were older. Several races were represented. Equal opportunity beheading, very PC, Clea thought, and smiled a little as she wrote this witticism down in her notebook. This was shaping up to be a fairly amusing article, even if the theater experience itself left something to be desired. When she looked back up, she noticed that the eyes of the heads were moving left and right, slowly, deliberately, as if taking in the entire audience. Clea knew the effect was likely controlled by the electrical cords, but it was still unsettling. The heads' gazes wandered back and forth, back and forth. When they lit on Clea, she felt a chill that started deep at the bottom of her spine. Even though the heads were only latex and ooze, damned if it didn't look like they were looking right at her, right through her. She found herself leaning forward in her chair like the others were, uncertain of what might happen next. She began to feel a little dizzy. After what seemed an eternity, the eyes passed over her and settled on the thin bearded man three rows behind her. Clea didn't dare turn to look, but she could feel their stares boring into the man, and she suddenly felt an immense wave of pity for him. No, leave him alone, she thought, realizing how crazy it was to be talking to a bunch of disembodied heads and talking to them about a man she'd never seen before in her life. Her notebook sat in her lap, momentarily forgotten. Suddenly, a voice boomed over the loudspeakers. You, it said. The voice was the same as the one that had spoken to her at the entrance, an odd vibrating voice that seemed to contain both male and female characteristics, but then again sounded of neither. The people in the audience did turn then, to see which one of their number had been singled out. Clea turned too, unwillingly, hearing her neck creak. A spotlight snapped on, blue and brilliant, and shone down upon the bearded man. His face looked round and terrified. There was a pregnant moment when time seemed to have come to a halt, all of them frozen there in the blue lights, staring at the man with the beard, the man who had been chosen instead of them. And then the scene began to move again as the man, his expression contorted and steeped in shadow, got to his feet, his chair protesting loudly as his weight left it. He stood in the spotlight, his hands folded before him. Any time, boomed the voice. The man looked as though he might cry. He looked around at the others, his eyes pleading, his muscles tensed as though ready to burst through his skin. Clea found that her earlier sympathy for him had dissipated, and when he looked at her, she simply stared back, dispassionate. Well, she thought, crossing her arms, do something. The man lowered his head, resigned. Clea could see his chest rising and falling as he breathed deeply in and out 5 or 6 times. At last, he raised his head. His eyes were glittering. And then, into the soaring silence of the theater, the man opened his mouth and began to sing. Clea stared, astonished at the sound that issued from his throat. Even though he had no microphone and looked petrified, his singing voice was like that of an angel, high and resonant, seeming to fill the entire space with its honeyed tones. The crystals on the chandelier seemed to shiver at the beauty of it. Clea felt a tear traveling down her cheek, and then another. She was too overcome to wipe them away. His song was unfamiliar, yet intimate with her very soul, the song of all humanity, the song of the spirit. The words were unintelligible, but unimportant. As it reached its climax, spiraling up to the heavens, Clea managed to tear her gaze away from the man and focus on the other people in the theater. They were all as transfixed as she, some of them openly weeping. The sound of his voice had opened a window into another dimension. At last, the song came to its conclusion, and the man closed his mouth, trapping the sublime sound behind his lips again. No one moved for a long moment, everyone savoring the last echoes as they died away. When the profound silence had fallen once more, the audience turned back toward the stage, where the heads floated in their jars. The heads blinked in perfect unison. And then, moving as one unit, they all began to turn from side to side, shaking their heads as if to say, no. Clea heard a sharp intake of breath from the man behind her, but she could not bear to look at him again. He had performed brilliantly, the beauty of his voice surpassing anything she'd ever heard, but apparently this was still not enough. She knew that he had failed in whatever test had been set for him, and although she was sorry for him, she was also ashamed that he had not succeeded. His failure was somehow the failure of them all. The spotlight was still trained on him. Clea could see its glow out of the corner of her eye. She heard him cry out and then start to blubber, the earlier clarity of his song degenerating into meaningless, anguished syllables. She cringed at the sound of it, wishing he could accept his fate with more dignity. As she watched, four figures in blue robes emerged from the wings and swept up the aisles, heading toward the man. Their faces were completely covered with thick cloth veils, but they seemed to have no trouble seeing where they were going. Clea found that she almost welcomed their coming, and her heart lifted as they neared the cowering man under the spotlight. He struggled as they grabbed him, but his efforts were clearly no use, as the hooded figures held him fast, animal strength radiating from their bodies. They picked him up by the arms and legs and carried him over the heads of the other patrons, out toward the aisle farthest from Clea. For a moment, she hoped that they would carry him up to the stage, that she would get to witness his final humiliation, but this was not to be. The man, still thrashing and screaming, was taken into the darkness at the side of the stage. Clea's notebook had slid off her lap and onto the floor, but she didn't notice it. She was strained forward in her chair, listening for some hint of the man's fate, her every muscle as taut as piano wire. She heard nothing, but saw that the others in the crowd were acting as she was, waiting and listening. The heads in the jars had closed their eyes again and floated peacefully in their thick solution. After a few minutes, one of the robed figures emerged onto the stage, footsteps echoing loudly in the silence. In his hands, he carried a large jar identical to the others, and inside the jar, the bearded man's head bobbed gently. Every now and then, a tiny ribbon of blood would issue from the fresh cut at the neck. The audience gave a collective sigh as the new head was set down upon the table next to the others. The robed figure then glided to the back of the stage, leaned down, and picked up a length of electrical cord, which he then proceeded to fasten to the new jar somehow, crawling beneath the table to do so. The moment the connection was made, the bearded man's eyes opened, as did those of all the other heads. The blue-robed figure bowed curtly to the heads, and then to the audience, disappearing into the wings without another sound. Clea's heart was hammering in her chest. "They've got to pick me next," she was thinking. "I won't fail them the way that man did." She looked around at the others in the crowd, who had now become her rivals. "I'm better than any of you. They have to pick me." As the eyes of the disembodied heads began to roam the audience once more, Clea stretched forward in her seat, fighting the urge to wave her arms in the air for attention. Surely they had to see that she was better, didn't they? They would have to see it. When their eyes met hers, she pleaded silently with them, putting all the emotion she could muster into her gaze. "I'm the one," she thought at them. "I'm the one you've been looking for." But the eyes passed her by, scanning the crowd for other possibilities. Clea slumped back in her chair, feeling the weight of devastation pressing down upon her. This wasn't right. They had to realize that she was the only one, so why didn't they? Were they just playing games with her? Clea barely noticed when the heads focused their attention upon a slim woman near the front of the theater. As the spotlight shone down on her, the woman stood and shrugged out of her coat. Underneath, she wore a spangled red costume with a flared skirt made from red and orange feathers. Delicately, she stepped into the aisle as music began to play, coming from somewhere Clea couldn't see. It was Stravinsky, the Firebird Suite. The woman began to dance, the sparkles on her leotard catching the light and making her shimmer like a candle flame as she leaped and twirled. She was very good, Clea admitted grudgingly to herself, perhaps even better than the man had been. She seemed weightless in the way she moved, the lines of her body like wisps of smoke upon the air, perfect timing, perfect grace. She flitted up and down the aisle, and Clea couldn't help but watch her and be spellbound. When the music was over, the dancer stood tall, holding her position, breathing hard, beads of sweat twinkling on her skin. The heads considered her in silence, blinking as one, and then, as Clea had known they would, they indicated that their answer was again, no. The dancer's face fell, but she took her rejection much better than the man had, letting herself be led away by the hooded figures, without so much as a word of regret. A few minutes later, her severed head duly appeared in its jar, right next to that of the bearded man. She blinked once, then closed her eyes. The other heads followed suit. Clea leaned forward in her chair again, knowing that this time it would be her turn, but then she saw that the blue lights over the stage were beginning to flicker out one by one, and the heavy curtains were slowly drawing closed. The show was over. "No!" Clea screamed in her head, looking around wildly at the others in the audience, who had begun to gather up purses and coats. "No, it isn't fair. It was supposed to be me next. Me." The others were getting up out of their seats and heading toward the aisles. None of them spoke, but a few of them smiled at each other, as if in recognition. They seemed like normal people now, the hypnosis which had held them there for the last hour and a half now completely dissolved. They could have been any audience leaving any show, anywhere in the world. Clea didn't get out of her seat. She crossed her arms, thinking petulantly that she would sit here all night if she had to. They'd have to give her a chance then. All she had to do was wait, and eventually they would see her and know that she was the one they wanted. She had to be stubborn. Shuffling footsteps sounded behind her. "First time here?" someone whispered. She turned, her jaw set. "Who wants to know?" The young man behind her smiled, his eyes blinking behind his glasses. "Hey, don't bite my head off. I remember the first time I came here. I felt the same way." Clea scowled at him. He was sandy-haired and very tall, clad in a gray sweater. She hadn't noticed him in the crowd before. "Leave me alone," she said. His smile didn't falter. "Look, you can't wait here. It doesn't work that way." He offered her a hand, but she didn't take it. He sighed. "Believe me, I've been coming here for 3 weeks now. You'll get picked when you get picked. That's just the way it is." Finally, she relaxed her scowl, unfolded her arms. "3 weeks?" she asked him. "Yeah, not every night, but most nights." He laughed, a pleasant sound in the gathering gloom. "I'll get picked eventually. I just know it." Clea laughed with him, then hitched up her shoulder bag and got to her feet. If the poor dope wanted to think he was the one, then let him. She wouldn't spoil his illusions. "Want to walk me out?" she said. "Sure." He held out his arm and she hooked her fingers through it. "Are you going to be back tomorrow?" he asked. "Of course," Clea answered. "And the night after that, and the night after that," she thought, but didn't say out loud. She smiled at the young man and let him talk as he led her up the stairs and out of the theater, back out into the narrow alley, and back onto the street, which was now well-lighted and populated with old men walking their dogs, couples strolling hand in hand. Clea realized that she'd forgotten her notebook back at the theater, but then she dismissed it as unimportant. The man beside her was prattling on and on about something equally unimportant, but Clea smiled and nodded in all the right places. She thought she might like to take him back to her apartment, perhaps have a few drinks. Maybe then things could get a little serious. As the theater of the Observer was swallowed up by the darkness behind them, Clea tightened her grip on her new companion's hand. Tomorrow night was for performance, but tonight she would eliminate some competition.
"Gentlemen, calm yourselves. There's no occasion for an uproar. Be seated again, be seated, all of you, I beg. Honor me with your attention for a moment. Signor Orsacchino has called me a murderer. He need not repeat the epithet, we've all heard it. Some of you gentlemen, I did not recognize the voices, so far forgot yourselves as to suggest that I should cross swords with Signor Orsacchino here and now, or that I should call him out and fight him at once. Gentlemen, I brook no suggestions as to what I should or should not do upon any point of honor. I permit no man to school me as to when or to what extent I should consider myself offended. Still less would I fail to resent any question of the propriety of my ignoring what other men dare not ignore. Signor Orsacchino has shown his courage by applying to me, before so many of you, a term of such serious import. He can incur no dishonor by hearing out in silence what I wish to say before we proceed to a final settlement. As victor in some score of duels, I pray your indulgence if for once in my life I depart from my habits, and instead of fighting at once and keeping silence, talk first and fight afterwards, or not at all. You, as my friends, will do me the honor to listen to me. Signor Orsacchino, as my enemy, will do himself the honor to hearken. A young man, and one who has never yet taken part in a serious combat, He has exhibited his conscientious conviction of the justice of his views and proved his valor and daring by bearding a master of fence who, in 15 years, has never failed to kill his man. As a skilled swordsman, I should feel myself a murderer indeed, were I take upon my soul his blood in haste. The Signora is young, the wine has passed rather freely, we are heated. I say earnestly, let no man interrupt me, that if Signor Orsacchino tomorrow, in cool daylight, chooses to reiterate his words, I shall take them as a deadly insult, and shall challenge, meet, and slay him without compunction. If, on the other hand, after I have told my story, he does not repeat his accusations, I shall regard them, all of them, as not merely withdrawn, but as things never said at all. Signor Orsacchino has called me a murderer because I killed in a duel his kinsman, General Della Ribalda. That was more than 15 years ago, and it was my first formal duel. So far from being a seasoned fighter who butchered a feeble and heartbroken old man, I was then a boy, very raw, and to a great extent unpracticed, pitted against a cool, dexterous, and envenomed adversary. In the many encounters through which I have since passed, I recall not one which taxed me more severely or in which I ran a greater risk. In fact, the general would assuredly have killed me had he not chosen to fight with a sword, a perfect mate of my own, which I knew and recognized, a sword the sight of which converted me from an excited lad into a being strung far beyond the reach of any personal or paltry emotions, a thing all muscle, nerve, and will, perfectly coordinated, an infallible, supernaturally accurate incarnation of unhurried, predestined vengeance. We met in the meadow outside of the river gate. Our seconds are all alive, men of unimpeachable integrity, nobles of the loftiest traditions, of the most honorable lineage. There were other witnesses of the fight which was scrupulously fair, and which I won by mere force of right and justice. I believe that when I have had my say, all of you, and Signor Orsacchino not least, will admit that I had just cause, more than just cause, for any vengeance upon the general, that to treat him as a man of honor and meet him sword to sword was a condescension upon my part. So far from having forced him to meet me, his challenge to me was simultaneous with mine to him. Signor Orsacchino has insinuated what, if he were ever to put into words, "No, Signor, hear me out, you may then say what you please," I should resent far more bitterly than the epithet of murderer. You will all recall the sudden and lamented death of Signora Della Ribalda, more than 2 years after that of her husband. You will all remember that she, the most beautiful woman of our city, who was mourned by unsuccessful suitors beyond any count, left behind her a reputation for saintliness, such as few women have ever attained. I had indeed seen the Signora before my combat with her husband, but I say solemnly that until the carnival ball, I had never spoken to her, that until the morning after, just before the duel, I had not known whom I so admired. I admit that he challenged me upon her account, but his jealousy was as insensate as the spleen that drove him, whose household had escaped loss, to press an imaginary grievance upon me, whose house was most desolate of all, upon a morning of general sorrow and desolation. If the story of my grievance, all too weak a word, against him, has never before been told by me, it is not because I have any reason to be ashamed of it, but rather, chiefly, that I was not willing to smirch the name of Della Ribalda with a tale of villainy so cynical. And after the custom of our family, I reserve everything involving penitence or repentance for my confessor. You shall judge whether I am right in confessing to you all. I shall detain you but a few moments longer. Without penitence, I cannot speak of my brother Ettore. At the thought of him, I am convicted of ingratitude, that most universal, most unforgivable of the sins of youth. I failed to appreciate my brother Ettore. He was to me not merely a beloved comrade, he not only more than filled for me the place of the father I had lost, but also of the mother I had never known. His tenderness was as exquisite as his precepts were wise, his concern universal, his care constant. I loved him with the ardent adoration of an unproved boy for a young, handsome, accomplished cavalier who is and does all that the boy longs to be and do. Yet although he stinted me in nothing, fulfilled for me all my reasonable desires, granted most of my wishes, humored my whims and bore with my moods, some malignant fiber of my heart drove me into perpetual opposition to him. His solicitude irked me, for with a boy's folly I mistook stubbornness for resolution, recklessness for valor, and self-assertion for independence. I misconstrued supervision as espionage. Resenting it, I began by evading perfectly natural questions as to my whereabouts and doings. From that, I grew into a contemptible habit of petty and unnecessary concealment as to my outgoings, incomings, and occupations. He bore this patiently, not showing any change of his affectionate and kindly bearing. Presently, my perversity drove me to run counter to his wishes in first one thing and then another. Because he had advised me to cultivate certain of my associates, I drew off from them. Because he had warned me against others, I made cronies of them, although I liked them little or not at all. I felt myself manlier for this sort of folly. I consorted with persons of dubious character or manifestly beneath me, resorted to quarters of the town I should have avoided, when I should have been diverting and improving myself in the best company possible for a young cavalier of our part of the world. I was roistering, by no means enjoying it, with fellows I heartily despised. I lost much money gaming, yet Ettore refilled my purse without chiding me in words, his manner conveying the just disapprobation I would not heed. I came home many times so late or so early that I found our porter difficult to wake, and more than once was nearly compelled to find shelter elsewhere. Sometimes I returned so disordered that I shrank from ascending the grand staircase and slunk around the courtyard under the galleries to the servitor's stair. I became habituated to low taverns across the river, where I naturally became involved in wine room quarrels and street brawls. I flattered myself that I comported myself well in these senseless melees. I dealt some shrewd wounds and came off unscathed. I felt all the man of pleasure. Then one night I was entrapped, I never realized how, in a street fight with several rufflers. One of my comrades fell and the rest fled, and I was left alone, my back to a barred door, facing several blades which I barely kept off, when a tall man appeared behind my assailants, fell upon them without warning, and promptly beat them off. After the sound of their fleeing feet had died away in the alleys, I found myself face to face with Ettore, wearing a cap without a feather and a plain brown cloak. He asked only, "You are not wounded?" "Not a scratch," I replied. "We will walk together, if you do not object," he said. "Which way are you going?" "Home," I answered. As we traversed the crooked streets, crossed the bridge, and made our way home, he kept silence at first, and then led me into some light gossipy talk, making no remark upon my silly foolhardiness, nor saying anything relative to his sudden appearance or my rescue. I should have been touched by his solicitude, but with a boy's folly, instead of being overwhelmed with gratitude to him for having saved my life, I was merely indignant at his having followed me and watched over me, and furious at the thought that he had felt that I, who aspired to be redoubtable, might be, as I was too headstrong to confess I had been, in need of assistance. After this adventure, my perversity was aggravated. I took the most sedulous precautions for my own hurt, doing all I could to preclude the possibility of Ettore's ever again being able to protect me from any possible consequences of the dangers into which I needlessly thrust myself. Throughout the carnival time, I fairly lived away from home, mostly, and this with Ettore's full knowledge, at the Palazzo Forticello with the wild Giambattista and his wilder brother Lorenzo. I took perverse care that Ettore should not be able to recognize me, changing my dress often and wearing a variety of masks. Throughout the carnival, I had been hoping to encounter a lady whom I had first seen the previous autumn, whom I had caught sight of but twice during winter, whom I had watched for in vain at the cathedral, and in the search for whom I had fruitlessly haunted every church in the city. It had so happened that on each of the three times I had seen her, I was alone. My descriptions had been unrecognizable to those of my friends whom I asked to enlighten me. When I had described her to Ettore, he had maddened me by saying that he knew well who the lady was, but declined to tell me, advising me to think no more of her, as her husband was devoted to her and a spleenful, dangerous man. I spurned his advice, but my fevered efforts won me no success. I had no clue to her, and even during the delirium of the carnival time, I had sighted no one whom I could take for her. This failure diminished my enjoyment of the week of revelry, but I had at least the satisfaction that I had not seen Ettore. No sense of his presence, of his hovering influence, dimmed the glow of my delight in feeling myself my own master and perfectly able to take care of myself, in getting into scrapes as I did, and getting out of them as I might, untrammeled. On the night of the Great Ball, I was dressed as a troubadour and was very proud of my becoming costume. No sooner had Lorenzo and I entered the theater than I saw the lady of my dreams. She wore a very narrow mask, no more than an excuse for a mask, and was dressed in fanciful garb, the significance of which I did not try to guess, but with the effect of which I was enraptured. She was with a very young man, and after a word with Lorenzo, using the freedom of the festal time, we accosted them. Lorenzo engaged the attention of her escort, while I gained possession of the lady. I may say that we spent the evening together, dancing countless dances, partaking of refreshments, strolling about, or seated on one or another of the benches in the corridors or loggias. So engrossed was I that it was only occasionally that I remembered to look about for Ettore. I never saw him, nor any figure at all suggesting his. But each time I looked among the crowd, the party-colored brightness of which was accentuated by a liberal sprinkling of cavaliers in black dominoes, all alike slender, youthful, and tall, I saw somewhere one figure that, as it were, stood out among the rest. A tallish, spare man of erect carriage, stiff bearing, and moving in a way not at all suggestive of youth, most absurdly and unbecomingly habited as a buffoon, not after the manner of our theater, but in the French fashion, all in white, with a tight-fitting cap, and a full false face whitened with flour, a loose white blouse, with huge white buttons big as biscuits, loose wide white trousers, and white slippers with white rosettes. This costume, odd enough on a young and plump figure, had an uncanny effect preposterously hung about the leanness of an elderly and frigid form. It was so unpleasantly weird that more than once my gaze dwelt on it for an instant, before it returned to peering through my dear comrade's mask at the half-revealed wonders of her dazzling eyes. Our conversation was very innocent, witty, we thought, delightful, we felt. It was near the unmasking time, when as we gave ourselves to the intoxication of one of the last dances, I heard Ettore's voice whisper in my ear. "Take care. Do not go home alone. You have been 3 hours with the wife of the most jealous man alive." I turned my head, and as well as I could in whirling through the whirling crowd, I looked about for Ettore. I did not catch sight of him, nor any costume such as he might be likely to wear. I saw only the everlasting party-colored whirl, the iterated black dominoes, the inevitable misfit zany. At the end of the dance, the youth, whom Lorenzo had removed for me, claimed my partner so peremptorily that I could not but resign her, and she, addressing him as cousin, went off with him. They had scarcely more than disappeared when, as I stood leaning against a pilaster, gazing across the press of dancers who thronged the floor at the dazzling parties which crowded every box of the Seven Tiers, a woman's shriek filled the hall. The next instant came the cry of fire, and almost before the boxes opposite me emptied, the blaze ran across the ceiling. I took no part in the mad panic which ensued. I stood petrified, as did a few others, and recovered my senses only when the billows of smoke rolled to the floor. Then, from under dropping masses of blazing decorations, through doors empty save for the trampled shapes of dead or insensible victims of the rush, I made my way from the auditorium. How I so made my way out, and by which door I do not know, the spectacle of the trampled women so sickened me that I marvel I ever escaped at all. For at the sight of a corpse not of my own making, I have always turned, I confess, utterly a coward. To gaze at a man dead by my sword does not disturb me. I see in it only the evidence that heaven's justice has made use of my hand to give a scoundrel his deserts. But a glimpse of a dead body, that of one not slain by me, makes my head swim, my eyes dazzle, my sinews loosen, my knees knock together. Before such a corpse I am, I may apply to myself what no other man would venture to hint, no better than a craven. Therefore, I shall never know how I came out of that furnace. I was delirious with horror, a mere animal driven by the primitive instinct of the dread of fire. The corridors and passageways were almost as full of smoke as the theater itself, and it seemed to me more aflame. I dare not venture to say how many stairways I seemed to find ablaze. The rush of the fire drove me in frantic flight hither and thither through several narrow doors, and, for down every stair I saw climbing flames, up more than one stair. I realized that I was quite out of the theater and on an upper floor of one or the other of the long disused, deserted palazzos which flanked it. I could not guess which, and whichever it might be, it was certainly as much on fire as the theater. I recall rushing through room after room, all filled with smoke, often turning back, finding no outlet and no way down. Several times I scrambled over heaps of what seemed to be old stage scenery. Once I stumbled and fell, jammed in a forest of broken lathes and scantlings. I do not know how I reached the window at which I finally found myself, nor where I was joined by that sinister figure in the white clown's dress, which I had remarked so often during the dancing. I was first aware of him beside me when I pushed vainly against the shut lattices of the window, and it was his strength, not mine, before which they gave way, not opening on their hinges, but carrying with them their crazy rotten frames, wrenched loose from the stonework of the window, and falling altogether with a splintering smash upon the pavement below. The noise of their crash struck our ears, while our eyesight was yet stunned by the impact of the hot brilliance with which, as the dislodged woodwork left the window aperture clear, we were flooded, diving upward, as it were, from the smoky obscurity of the interior into an intense ruby glare. We both scrambled upon the sill. There was no balcony outside. We were looking into a courtyard so filled with crimson radiance that not only were the walls opposite us bathed in an intense light, but the dark corners were penetrated by a weird carmine-tinted glow, even in the deepest shadows. There was not a human being in sight. The court was deserted. It was of considerable size, paved with big square blocks of black and white stone. I could make out on the side opposite us the opening of a wagon archway, yawning like a black throat. No arcades flanked the courtyard, and every window I could see was shuttered fast. There were 6 stories of windows, and we were at one of the 5th story. The roof cornice beetled above us, and roofs above the court were silhouetted against the inflamed sky, and overhead poured the vast inverted cataract of sparks which streamed up from the holocaust we had not yet escaped. We spoke no word. He stood upon the left side of the window, I upon the right. My lute I had, of course, thrown away, my mask I had on no longer. I had lost both sword and poniard. My whole belt was gone. I had nothing in my hands, which were torn and bleeding. The buffoon had a naked dagger in his right hand, a piece of rope in his left. He leaned over and scrutinized the outlook, as I did. We were a frightful distance above the pavement, and even had we been lower, dropping to the pavement would have been certain destruction, for precisely beneath us was a long, narrow area, about a yard wide, and how deep I could not guess, constructed to let light into some cellar. The coping along its edge, where the pavement ceased, showed as a line of dull light in the appalling illumination. There were no balconies to the windows below us, or to any of those immediately on the right or left of them. About halfway down the face of the wall, from just below the left of the window in which we were to the corner of the courtyard on that side, ran a broad stone cornice, wide enough for a lean man once standing upon it to walk along it without holding on to anything. About halfway to the corner of the court, a metal rain spout ran down, making a conspicuous elbow over the jutting stone shelf. Once set his feet upon this cornice, either of us was sure to escape. The end of it was not precisely below the left side of our window, but a little to the left. All this I took in a moment, so apparently did the other man. There were many flambeau brackets projecting from the walls of the courtyard. There was one beside each lower corner of our window. The buffoon took his dagger in his teeth, kneeled down, reached over and fastened one end of his rope to the flambeau socket. He did not hurry, but made sure of his knots. Then he dropped the rope, and holding to the bracket with his left hand, shook the rope into undulations with his right, peering down to descry its end. Its end was all of 10 feet above the level of the cornice, too far for a man holding the extreme end of it to set his feet upon the cornice top. To jump for that cornice, or to drop upon it from even a yard above, it would have meant the certainty of going down to be dashed to pieces on the cruel flagstones below. The buffoon pulled up the rope and stood up, his dagger still between his teeth, projecting from under the false face which it thrust away from his own, and through the eye holes of which I seemed to feel his eyes fixed upon me. We could hear, above the roar of the fire, the confused hubbub of shouts from the crowds which thronged the square and the streets round about. I had called for help when first I reached the sill, but my bawling, lost in the steady, deep rumbling note of the fire and in the confusion of voices beyond, won no response. Now I yelled again, screamed, shrieked, but no one heard. The buffoon echoed my outcries, but not as if assisting them, not as if hoping against hope for rescue, not as if, like myself, merely giving way to terror and despair, but rather with derisive mockery in his rallying halloos. I felt totally helpless. If I were to escape at all, it would be through him, yet I felt him as an inimical presence and feared him almost more than the fire behind us. He stood with the rope bunched inside his fingers. It seemed to me nervously knotting and unknotting it. Then he let most of it go slack, a coil of a loop or two swinging back and forth in his left hand, his face toward me, and his eyes, I felt, steadily on me. The tiny threads of lazy smoke that had been faltering out of the window under the lintel increased from a thin trickle to a continuous stream. Through the door of the room behind us was visible a faint blush of blurred brownish light. As I looked at it, I saw the door darken suddenly. A man rushed through it, incredibly alive out of the throttling reek, crossed the room in a bound, and leaped upon the sill between us. He was all in black, black cap, black mask, black domino, black hose, and his sword in a black scabbard. So swift was his rush, so impetuously did he leap, that I wondered whether he had meant to set foot on the windowsill or had expected to land on a balcony outside. As it was, he planted his feet fairly on the sill, but just missed pitching forward into space. He toppled, bent double, and saved himself only by touching the outer sill with the outstretched fingers of his tense arm. At this instant, as the masked black domino rocked unsteadily, head and shoulders into the outer air, the zany flung the noose, for it was by no means a snarl of rope, but a cunningly knotted slip noose, which he had held inside his closed left hand, over the newcomer's head, and with one lightning movement, half-dragged, half-hurled him from the sill. In the air, the victim spread out arms, legs, and cloak, like a huge bat. His hands windmilled wildly, searching for the rope, and failed to touch it. For a horrid instant, as the rope checked its headlong dive, the inverted body gave a jolted bob upward before it turned, then it lurched over, the hands making one last clutch for the rope, and again missing. The cord drew up straight as a rapier blade, and held. The body was violently and convulsively agitated once or twice, and its sword, tossed out of the upturned scabbard, struck the corner of the cornice with a sharp clang, bounded up, flashing in the red glare, and shot down a long line of light to the pavement. Its owner's corpse writhed sinuously, and then merely gyrated limply at the end of the rope. Its feet were not much more than a man's height above the cornice. My abomination of the sight unnerved me so that my impulse to hurl myself upon the murderer was swallowed up in a physical sickness in which I nearly fell from the sill. As I clung to the stone jamb, the malignant white shape, dagger in hand, addressed me. "Sir, I know who you are. I was about to piece my rope with your carcass. Since this intruding stranger has spared me the necessity, and since the rope is now long enough to be useful, I offer you the courtesy of the first opportunity to descend." Speechless with horror and loathing, I tottered, a helpless jelly, against the jamb. He stood, his long dagger in his right hand, eyeing me through his whitened mask. "Ah," he went on, "you hesitate. You can pass me easily, descend by the bracket, the rope, the cornice, and the rainspout. You will not? Then you will pardon me if I leave you. You will find it warm here before long. Nevertheless, if this place is more to your liking than the street, I do not dispute your right of choice. A good night to you. I'm tempted indeed to put this dagger into you before I go, but I reflect that though you do not look it, you might have the strength and sleight to avoid my thrust, and perhaps even throw me down. I shall not risk it. If you overcome your panic and are not burned here or killed by falling, if, in short, you get down alive and get home, you shall hear from me in the morning." He leaned over, tore off, and threw away his false face, and revealed to me a countenance I did not then recognize. Next, his dagger in his teeth, he dived for the bracket, caught it with both hands, swung himself off into space, gripped the rope, first with one hand, then with both, went down it, stood on the dead man's shoulders, let himself down the rope till he clasped the corpse, wriggled down it, embracing it close, dislodging the cloak, which sailed down the air like some huge bird, and settled upon the pavement far out into the court near the sword. The escaping villain finally gripped one ankle of the corpse with each hand, swung himself and all above him gently sideways until his feet found the cornice, steadied himself by the feet of the corpse, let go and stood up, edged gingerly along the cornice to the rainspout, and slid down it smoothly. Once on the pavement, he leaped into the air, clapping his hands and crowing, scampered briskly across the court, stopped to pick up his victim's cloak and sword, turned to glance up at me, waved me a derisive farewell, and after a hideous caper of joy, vanished into the black throat of the wagon archway, running like a fiend. My eyes came back to the dangling body, revolving slowly now. Its mask hung beside the neck, and the back of the head was toward me. I felt myself doomed. I knew I could never summon up resolution to escape by that road. In fact, I am sure that from losing my hold, as I actually later descended, and being dashed to pieces on the pitiless stones, nothing saved me but the set fixed purpose of vengeance, which made me not a man, but an automaton. I looked behind me. The glare of the fire was bright through the smoke, dense volumes of which poured out of the window above my head, and the heat of which I could feel. At that instant came a terrific dragging crash, a brief darkness, and an agonized wail of groaning shouts. The roof of the theater had fallen in. The smoke sucked back through the window above me, and momentarily I felt cool air on my face. The next instant, the volume and intensity of the light redoubled as the overarching stream of sparks became a firmament of fire. The court grew bright to the deepest, darkest corner. Eddies of air swept past me. The corpse swung round. Its mask blew away wholly. Hideously bowed, the head was, the chin driven into the bosom. But I knew the face of my brother Ettore.